Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. A listener note, this series is about a shameful chapter in American history. As part of telling the story accurately, we present the point of view of doctors and others from the period who express racist and white supremacist views. Listener discretion is advised. Charles Pollard isn't used to government doctors. He's not used to doctors, period. No one here is. Black people in Macon County, Alabama, which is most people here, they just don't have the money. If you think you might die, well, sure, you try and find a doctor. But short of that, you figure it out yourself. That's why today, in late October 1932, Pollard is shocked by the sign he sees outside the schoolhouse not far from his family farm. The words suggest that times are changing, that finally, maybe somewhere out there cares about what's going on in Macon. The sign reads, "Free blood test, free treatment by county health department and government doctors. You may feel well and still have bad blood. Come and bring all your family." Pollard is 26 and feels perfectly fine, but bad blood? He's never thought of that. What if there is something wrong? It's best to get checked out. So when he gets to the schoolhouse, he joins a line of local people already waiting. They're mostly men like him, farmers in their work shirts and overalls, though there are a few women too. They file into the building one after the other. When it's Pollard's turn, the white doctor he meets is friendly enough, even asks if the needle stuck in his arm for the blood test hurts.
No, it feels fine.
That's good, Mr. Pollard, very good. Are you married?
Sure, I'm married.
Do you work?
Of course I do. Got a farm where I live, out in Notasulga. Got some cattle, grow corn. Even got one of those mechanical cotton picking machines. We're probably the first...
All done. Thank you, Mr. Pollard. You can roll your sleeve back down.
Well, actually, doctor, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
While I was waiting, I saw a woman go in, bent back, coughing, couldn't make a move without it hurting. I saw her come out later and looked just as bad as before. She said the doctor in there told her she was fine, not sick, just old.
I see.
So I guess I'm just wondering what kind of doctor's office this is. She didn't get no blood test.
Well, her doctor could probably tell that whatever that woman had, it wasn't bad blood.
But what does that mean, though?
Well, it can mean a lot of things, but mainly it means this. If we find out you have it, we've got to bring you in. You'll be notified by mail. Have a nice day, Mr. Pollard.
Pollard rises and says goodbye. He's got a funny feeling, and it lingers as he heads back home. Bad blood. The doctor didn't exactly answer his question. But maybe that's just how doctors are. They know a lot of things that other people don't. Best just to trust them.
Charles Pollard doesn't know that the government doctors aren't here to treat anyone. They're here hunting for test subjects, black men like him. In a few days, a government doctor will contact him and tell him to come back to the clinic. Pollard's tested positive for bad blood. It will be 40 years before he finds out he was lied to. 40 years before he learns that he really was sick. But no one tried to cure him.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. The Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male began in 1932. Charles Pollard was one of 623 test subjects who would become unwittingly enrolled with no idea they were being used. Ironically, the study had grown out of a real treatment program, but by 1932, the doctor's objectives had changed. They were curious to see what happened when the potentially deadly disease ran its full course and eager to document the unique ways it would ravage the black male body. And so they let the study's test subjects go untreated, seeing their suffering and eventual deaths as necessary sacrifices on the march towards scientific progress. This is Episode 2, Treatment by Autopsy. It's early November 1932, and it's pouring outside. Dr. Raymond Vondelaer can't stand this weather. In his lab at the Tuskegee Institute, he stares at the neatly sorted vials of black men's blood and realizes he has a problem. When Dr. Oliver C. Wenger opened the treatment and diagnostic centers last month, the blacks came, hundreds of them, from Shorter, Haraway, Notasulga. Vondelaer had been impressed. Wenger clearly knew what he was doing. When the men came, he and the other doctors listened patiently as they described their ailments. They gave advice and medicine where they could, but their main goal was to identify men with syphilis who were at least 25 years old. Wenger had told Vondelaer that they'd lowered the age from 30 because the pool of subjects was so much bigger. Once they had their men, they hired Vondelaer to run the field study of the untreated disease. When he first got the call, Vondelaer was elated. He felt like his whole career had been leading to this moment. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Medicine and a native of that state, and he's been with the PHS for 7 years. Dr. Tolliver Clark and Dr. Wenger picked him because he'd taught syphilology at the Medical College of Virginia. Plus, he'd studied cardiovascular syphilis under some of the finest instructors in Europe. Vondelaer knows this made him the perfect candidate. Dr. Clark is extremely curious to learn more about how the late-stage symptoms affect Negroes, and Vondelaer shares his curiosity. But if the blacks won't cooperate, then Vondelaer and Clark don't have a study. And this is what has him worried now. As he sits in his lab, with that damnable rain threatening to cave in the roof, he begins a letter to his boss. He tells Clark that he now has samples from 300 patients, and that's a good start. But Vondelaer adds, "We are now wondering what will happen next when we try to get the Negroes in for study at the Institute Hospital." Days later, he receives Dr. Clark's reply. He seems just as nervous, telling Vondelaer he's also worried that the men won't agree to physicals. But amazingly, they do. None of the local test subjects see anything wrong with being physically examined. They seem excited even, pleased to be getting medical attention. Vondelaer, a lifetime Southerner, could kick himself for wasting all that time worrying. He should have known better. These people understand who's in charge. After the initial blood test, Vondelaer brings in the positives for a second test just to confirm. After that, he whittles the pool down further, excluding any man who's been infected for less than 5 years or treated for syphilis in the past. It's easy to find the people he wants. Having a friendly young black nurse like Eunice Rivers doesn't hurt. Vondelaer has her working 14 hours a day. When she's not driving the potential test subjects to and from the hospital, she's helping with the physical exams, boiling and washing syringes, making sure all the supplies are in order. Vondelaer is greatly appreciative, and so is Charles Pollard. Pollard's day starts early with a drive from his farm to the Tuskegee Institute. It's a rough ride. Nurse Rivers' coupe doesn't have rumble seats, and the rain has made Macon County's dirt roads muddy and hard to maneuver. But even though Pollard's nearly sick to his stomach from the ride, now that he's in the Tuskegee waiting room, he's starting to feel better about this treatment program. He and Nurse Rivers had a lot of time to chat,
and she's assured him that the white government doctors are here to help. Any question at all, he can ask her, and Pollard likes that. She brings over a smiling white man in a lab coat. This must be the doctor. He reaches out to shake Pollard's hand.
Good morning, Mr. Pollard. I'm Dr. Vondelaar. If you'll follow me, please, we'll get your examination underway. So, feeling okay, Mr. Pollard?
I'm feeling fine, thank you.
Well, that's great. Well, I suppose we should get started.
Nurse Rivers nods to the doctor and quietly shuts the door on her way out of the examination room.
Now, Mr. Pollard, I don't want you to worry about the diagnosis. Just be glad we caught it in time. I've never felt like anything was wrong with me. Of course, I see what I've got down there, but it doesn't bother me none. Totally understandable, Mr. Pollard, totally understandable. Now, if you'll remove your pants and underwear, please. Yes. How long have you had these sores? 5 or 6 years, I'd say.
Vondelaar jots down some notes. When he doesn't say anything more, Pollard asks the obvious question.
Like I said, Doctor, the sores never bothered me. But do you know what they are? Do I need medicine?
The doctor places his pen down on his notepad, looks up slowly at Pollard, and smiles.
No medicine needed, Mr. Pollard. Charlie, please. Charlie, I don't want you to be concerned. Your lesions, they're nothing more than a complication of bad blood.
Pollard is relieved, but there's still something bothering him.
And what is bad blood? No one here's told me. Well, it's too complicated to explain, really. You're better off not worrying about such things. But the important thing is you're here. And from now on, we'll take care of you. We'll just keep an eye on that bad blood of yours, and we'll do what we can to help.
Vondelaar beams at him.
Charlie, do you understand how lucky you are?
Lucky?
Yes, you and your friends here. You're some of the luckiest Negroes in America.
In the coming days, Vondelaar starts feeling decidedly unlucky, though. Just over 400 men had been selected for the program so far, but analysis of their blood has led to disheartening results. He'd hoped to find paresis, the stage where syphilis affects the brain, leading to madness and paralysis. None of these blacks are showing the obvious signs. It's very disappointing. He's never had the chance to watch paresis develop and has been looking forward to it, wanted to record the effects, but now it looks like he may not get the chance, which is a shame, really. Worried, he once again sits down in his lab and writes Dr. Clark. I am aware of the great difficulty offered in recognizing the early subjective symptoms of paresis in the Negro, but it seems unusual that I have failed to recognize a single early case of paresis with subjective symptoms in the 200-odd cases examined. Dr. Clark's response arrives the following week and lifts Vondelaar's spirits somewhat. He tells Vondelaar not to blame himself. It's to be expected. After all, the test subjects are low-class blacks, so it will be harder to distinguish between madness and simple ignorance. Clark writes, I quite agree with you as to the hopelessness of recognizing mild paresis among these illiterate people of such circumscribed cultural horizon. I am hopeful that the spinal fluid examinations may throw some light on this question. The following day, Dr. Vondelaar makes an announcement to his staff at the Tuskegee Institute. They're going to begin doing spinal fluid examinations, also known as lumbar punctures or spinal taps. The staff murmurs in surprise. Vondelaar had hoped to delay this procedure until 6 to 8 months from now, when the project is scheduled to wrap up, but the search for paresis demands the work begin now. Spinal fluid analysis will do what clinical observation cannot and reveal what's truly going on inside the brain. He tells his staff it will likely be unpleasant work for them and certainly for the patients. Seeing he has their attention, Vondelaar goes into detail. He reminds them that having fluid drawn from one's spine is extremely painful no matter how careful the doctor is, and the doctor must always be careful. If the needle is inserted even slightly off the mark, the patient may suffer permanent paralysis. Even if no mistake is made, a large number of patients will likely report intense headaches, coupled with stiffness or numbness in the neck, arms, and legs following the procedure. Our goal is to avoid the worst-case scenario, Vondelaar tells his staff. These men must not be permanently damaged. These men are all volunteers and must remain volunteers, Vondelaar thinks. They need to be confident that the doctors are doing all they can to cure them of bad blood. Confident and cooperative. If someone ends up crippled or in debilitating pain for weeks, word will spread, and the test subjects will withdraw. It's a dilemma, but Vondelaere's found a way around it. The solution is to lie to the men about the risks, then cross his fingers that none of them suffer serious injury. Individual patients would be told they're coming in for an examination. Once they're in the door, they'll be told they're getting a spinal shot. Not a lumbar puncture or a spinal tap, but a simple therapeutic shot. Vondelaere's proud of the phrasing. The men are already used to getting shots to make their bad blood better, so news of another one shouldn't scare them. He's also decided that after the puncture, they'll remain at Tuskegee overnight so the doctors can watch for negative side effects. Vondelaere tells his team that they'll be performing 20 spinal taps every day. In another letter, Vondelaere is completely honest with Dr. Clark about the risk he's taking. When Clark replies, he isn't the least bit concerned and doesn't think the test subjects will cause any trouble. As he puts it, these Negroes are very ignorant and easily influenced by things that would be of minor significance in a more intelligent group. So with the blessing of his superiors, Vondelaere composes another letter, this time to his test subjects. He makes sure the document looks as official as a piece of paper possibly can, listing out every organization that signed onto the project. The letterhead reads, Macon County Health Department, Alabama State Board of Health, and U.S. Public Health Service cooperating with Tuskegee Institute. Beneath that, Vondelaere writes, Dear Sir, some time ago you were given a thorough examination, and since that time, we hope you have gotten a great deal of treatment for bad blood. You will now be given your last chance to get a second examination. This examination is a very special one, and after it is finished, you will be given a special treatment if it is believed you are in a condition to stand it. When he's finished typing, Vondelaere grins, rather pleased with himself. With talk of special treatments, very special examinations, and last chances, it's quite the sales pitch, and it works. Scores of study patients enthusiastically embrace the opportunity to submit to a painful and risky procedure they don't know is coming. In May of 1933, at the Tuskegee Institute's Andrew Hospital, the spinal taps begin.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Nurse Rivers grips the steering wheel tight. When she brakes or accelerates, she tries to be as gentle as possible. She's doing her best, but knows her best is not good enough for Carter Howard. It's not his fault. He's just had the needle.
Slow down. Slow down. Don't drive so fast. God, it hurts. Hang on, Mr. Carter. Almost home. I can't handle this, Nurse Rivers. I can't.
Yes, you can. You'll feel better soon.
God damn, is it supposed to hurt this much?
I promise what you're feeling right now is perfectly normal.
This isn't the first time Nurse Rivers has lied to a test subject, and it certainly won't be the last. But truthfully, she's surprised Howard isn't in more pain. She was there for his spinal tap, and it was awful. The doctor stuck him 2 or 3 times before he got it right, and each time Howard cried out in pain. All these spinal taps have been hell on the men. She drives them home as carefully as she can, but there's only so much she can do with her shabby car on these rocky dirt roads.
It knocked me out, Nurse Rivers. I fainted in there. I fainted, you know.
She does know.
You just lie down when you get home and rest, you hear? Just give it a few days. I'm telling you, Nurse Rivers, if they're going to stick you in the back every time we go in there, I don't want to be there. That's the only time, Mr. Howard, you are all done. All right, we're here. You wait just a minute, Mr. Howard. I'll come around to help you through your front door.
Nurse Rivers leaves Howard grimacing on his couch, cursing the government doctors. As she drives back to the hospital, she thinks about how he's not the only one she's left like that. Nearly every man who underwent a lumbar puncture emerged worse for the wear, many vowing never to return, even though she's sworn to them that the spinal shots are a one-time thing. It's a serious problem. When she gets back to Tuskegee, she personally approaches Dr. Vondelaar and informs him that three of the test subjects refuse to come in. Others have offered various excuses. She does everything she can to change their minds, but they're too afraid. Vondelaar's prepping for the next spinal tap as they talk, and she can see he's not worried. He tells her she shouldn't be either. Are some of the men going to drop out? Sure. But that always happens in any kind of study where human test subjects are involved. What's important is the staff have performed 307 spinal punctures in just a few weeks. Dr. Wenger has said he considers this a remarkable showing. Nurse Rivers finds herself nodding along. Then Vondelaar tells her to get back to work, and she does. What else could she do? Nurses shouldn't question doctors, women shouldn't question men, and blacks shouldn't question whites. It's June 1933, and after 9 months, it's finally time for the Tuskegee syphilis study to conclude. The final spinal tap is conducted, and Vondelaar starts saying his goodbyes. He bids farewell to the Tuskegee physicians who return to their regular posts. He thanks Nurse Rivers for her help and wishes her well in pursuit of her next job. This experiment has been such an adventure, Vondelaar thinks to himself as he closes up the clinic. Feeling much like a small child ordered to put away his toys, he realizes he isn't ready for the fun to end, but nothing to be done. He returns to D.C. to the PHS building and walks down the long hallway to Dr. Clark's office for a debrief. He expects all the regular things one expects from these meetings. Good work, Raymond. We're proud of you, Raymond. What's next for you, Raymond? But instead, Vondelaar sits down opposite Dr. Clark and hears some surprising news. Clark has decided to retire. The PHS needs a new director of the Division of Venereal Diseases, and the PHS and Dr. Clark already know who they would like to take over. In an instant, Vondelaar accepts. He immediately sees the potential for new research, the opportunity to explore fresh scientific frontiers, and above all, the power to decide the fate of the Tuskegee syphilis study. Why does it have to end now? Just when he and his co-workers are on the cusp of genuine insight into the impact of untreated syphilis on Negroes. Why does the study have to end at all? Under Director Vondelaar, it doesn't. Vondelaar says all of this out loud. A tone of fervor begins to rise in his voice. True, the test subjects don't know they have syphilis. Yes, they were manipulated into getting their spines punctured. Maybe some people would question the tactics, but what they're too short-sighted to grasp is that actually, Vondelaar is a friend to the Negro. He's found some truly serious late-stage pathologies in many of the test subjects. If he can demonstrate just how bad untreated syphilis can be for a black man, then perhaps Congress will take the disease more seriously and fund more treatment programs and facilities. Dr. Clark, he says, we would be medical pioneers. Meanwhile, Dr. Oliver Wenger is happily back at home. The place he considers his true home, that is, the venereal disease clinic he built in Hot Springs, Arkansas. In the clinic today, he makes his daily rounds. He examines new patients, warmly greeting old ones. He realizes that he honestly missed them. After Tuskegee, he's more passionate about helping Negroes than ever. It's a wonderful time to be a Negro, after all. In the past, no one gave a damn about their health. Nowadays, they have doctors like himself and Dr. Raymond Vondelaar to look after them. In a cheerful mood, he passes by his secretary and asks if the day's mail has come in. Smiling, she hands it over. I'll be in my office for the next 15 minutes or so, he says. And once at his desk, he sits down and sorts through the many envelopes. One return address stands out. Dr. Raymond Vondelaar, Public Health Service Director of the Division of Venereal Diseases, Washington, D.C. Wenger reaches for the letter opener and begins to read. After a few lines, he grins. Ray's barely held the office a month, but he's wasting no time. Vondelaar has been corresponding with various health officers and reviewed all relevant syphilis-related literature. And he's come to a definitive conclusion that will transform the Tuskegee study for the better and forever. Vondelaar confidently states, "Everyone has agreed that the proper procedure is the continuance of the observation of the Negro men used in the study with the idea of eventually bringing them to autopsy." Wenger can't believe it. Not only does the study live, but Dr. Vondelaar wants to continue it until the test subjects die. Wenger nods. Such a long-term, longitudinal study would be groundbreaking and immeasurably further medical science. Observations made by doctors looking at x-rays will never match the observations pathologists can make looking at damaged organs under a microscope. There's just no substitute for the real thing. And as always, Vondelaar has already anticipated the objections. Wenger did think to himself, if the men are to be observed until the end of their lives, then when does the study actually end? But Vondelaar has an answer ready. Autopsies may be, quote, impractical in connection with some of the younger cases, but, he goes on, those more advanced in age with serious complications of the vital organs should have to be followed only for a period of a few years. Inspired, Wenger turns to his typewriter and begins to draft his reply. Naturally, there's the question of how the black men in Macon County might feel about all of this. Wenger supplies a simple answer. Fall back on the tried and true strategy and keep the patients in the dark. Most of these people won't like the idea of autopsies. Carving up the body after death and stitching it back together won't sit right with them. These are simple Christian folk, after all. So Wenger writes, just don't tell them. He adds, if the colored population become aware that accepting free hospital care means a post-mortem, every darkie will leave Macon County and it will hurt Dibble's Hospital. This can be prevented if the doctors of Macon County are brought into our own confidence and requested to be very careful not to let the objectives of the plan be known. He suggests that they make sure all the county's private doctors know that if someone dies in their care, their body should be turned over directly to the PHS for autopsy. Wenger takes note of Vondelaar's other ideas. Not all of them are correct, and here Wenger knows he can be of help. His suggestions made, he finishes up his letter, signs it, and hands it to his secretary for her to send by the end of the day. Vondelaar, in his brand new D.C. office, is elated to find that Wenger clearly shares his sense of urgency. Less than a week has gone by and already has an envelope from Hot Springs. This must be Wenger's response to the news that the study is alive and well. Vondelaar tears it open and is relieved to find that Wenger completely agrees with bringing the men to autopsy. He does take issue, however, with the continued employment of Nurse Rivers. She's not a bad nurse in Wenger's opinion, but Wenger notes, she's too soft with the men. He writes, I don't see that she can do anything else than use up gasoline making weekly calls on these patients, which do not seem to me to be necessary. Though they may be friends to their neighbors, husbands to their wives, and fathers to their sons, to the medical staff, the men in the study are none of these things. They are test subjects. Wenger puts it like this, as I see it, we have no further interest in these patients until they die. Vondelaar thinks it over. Wenger is saying the test subjects don't need a colored nurse babying them, but he disagrees. In his reply, he tells Wenger, unless someone is working locally with the idea of constantly keeping the welfare of the study in mind, very little will be accomplished, and so Nurse Rivers will stay. Vondelaar does take one of Wenger's other suggestions. Wenger wants the black pathologist with the U.S. Veterans Bureau Hospital, Dr. Jerome J. Peters, to handle autopsies. They've worked closely with Peters already. He did many of the spinal taps. It's a good idea, Vondelaar thinks. The more black doctors and nurses are a part of this thing, the better. Dr. Eugene Dibble's mind races as he listens to Dr. Vondelaar share his updated plans for the syphilis experiment. Vondelaar smiles too much, talks too quickly, and of course uses all the right words. Dibble appreciates the effort, though inwardly, he chuckles a bit. White men often get like this on the rare occasion when they need to ask a Negro for something and just can't order him to do it. After a few moments, Dibble asks for clarification on one key point.
So if I understand correctly, Dr. Vondelaar, this study is now to last indefinitely. Well, I don't know that I'd use that word specifically. I prefer to use the term open-ended. Will the experiment end? Of course it will, but why end it prematurely? Before we've truly learned everything there is to learn.
To Dibble, this sounds perfectly reasonable, but for some of the test subjects he sees every day, it does sound like a death sentence. But if such a cost is going to be paid, then he'll at least ensure it's a cost beneficial to Tuskegee in the long run.
If the new aim of this study is to bring the patients to autopsy, that means you'll want to use Tuskegee facilities, nurses, and interns for the duration.
That is correct, and we've already secured the funding.
And you'll have reliable people performing the autopsies. Autopsies will be handled personally by Dr. Peters and yourself, sir, if you're open to it. Nurse Rivers will be on hand. This would be a very valuable education for her, as I'm sure you're aware.
This pleases Dr. Dibble. It's exactly what he wanted to hear.
I am aware. And I look forward to the continuation of our partnership.
As do I, Dr. Dibble. This is truly historic-making work we're doing. A rich study of the effects of syphilis on the human economy.
Dr. Dibble has to stifle a scoff. The human economy. He's certain that when Vondelaer discusses this study with his fellow white doctors, it's Negro male this and Negro male that. Not so much when he's forced to discuss it with an actual Negro male. But Dibble thinks the semantics have some value. No one can accuse him of knowingly collaborating on a study potentially harmful to blacks. Besides, what he does for the good of his organization and the good of all his people.
Yes, Dr. Vondelaer, this will be a rich study of the effects of syphilis on the human economy, indeed.
In the months to come, the doctors cement plans for the study's next phase. Not only will the men be brought to autopsy, but there will be more men. A control group. In late July 1933, Dibble receives a letter from Vondelaer informing him the study should add, quote, a number of control cases having no evidence of syphilis. Dibble pauses to take that in. It means roughly 300 new test subjects. Vondelaer writes that adding the control group will clarify the disease's effects on the body. Those black men with syphilis can now be compared directly to those without, under similar clinical conditions. Of course, they too will be deceived as to the true nature of the study. Dibble sighs and begins composing a reply, agreeing to the proposal. There's little else for him to do. In November 1933, Vondelaer takes note of the fact that he has the full and enthusiastic cooperation of both the PHS and the Tuskegee Institute to continue the study. Now he has to get all the local medical society and board of health supervisors in and around Macon County on board. These organizations will be useful in keeping track of who dies. Vondelaer wants to make sure he knows about every single test subject death. To miss one would be disastrous, for the men must be promptly brought to autopsy. He decides he must rapidly schedule joint medical society and board of health meetings in each relevant Alabama county. He tells the officials he'll personally attend each meeting and explain the study in detail. For the next several weeks, he drives from county to county. At meeting after meeting, he's delighted to hear no objections. Instead, everyone agrees that this study is valuable and beneficial to the entire field of syphilis research. Vondelaer is delighted and returns to D.C. eagerly awaiting the influx of data surely about to come his way. And he doesn't have to wait long. The first man dies within weeks. The autopsies are hard on Nurse Rivers. For so long, work had been a joy. Now it just scares her. She doesn't like watching the doctors take saws to the men's bodies. She can't help but view the procedures as a regular person might, with horror. She reminds herself that she must be better than this. She's not a regular person. She's a nurse of the Tuskegee Institute, working on a pioneering study. Not long ago, Dr. Vondelaer told her that this experiment is very similar to one that was conducted in Norway on white men. This is simply the Negro version, he said, and it's very important. Rivers wants to reflect well on the nurses' training program that made her, on Dr. Dibble, who has given her so much. If not for her position, she would be out there struggling like so many other poor souls, desperate for employment in a Great Depression that shows no sign of ending. Rivers reminds herself that autopsies may be crude, but she can't hide from them. She remembers her father, tries to think of what he might say if he were here now. For the first time in weeks, she feels strong. Dr. Dibble is calling. She can hear him down the hall. It must be time for her to help with another autopsy. Nurse Rivers stiffens, but this time out of courage, not fear. She's doing meaningful work here, and her patients trust her. She'll just have to get used to seeing them cut apart.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
It's 1935, 2 years since the autopsies began, and Nurse Rivers is surprised by how far she's come. Before, she could only think of the fact that men she talked with, helped, comforted, and driven to and from their homes were now cold, lying on even colder slabs. From there, systematically sliced and disassembled, their brains, vital organs, and spinal cords removed and assessed. She was squeamish then, but not anymore. Now she's a true professional. Besides, autopsies can only take place if the dead men's families consent. It's her responsibility to secure that consent. A test subject died today. His next of kin expect her in the hospital waiting room any minute. It's tastefully furnished, but quiet and sterile. Kind of place where you feel you ought to whisper, even though there's really no need. This is not Nurse River's favorite room in the hospital, but she has a job to do. As she approaches, Rivers can hear a woman wail with grief. She enters the waiting room and sees the woman, the man's wife, sobbing. She stands with tissues in hand, staring at the floor.
Ma'am, may I sit with you for a moment? I'd like to speak to you about your husband.
Rivers sits, pauses a moment in respectful silence, and begins. She can tell this woman will not be easy to convince, so she takes it slow.
Your husband was, well, he was a great man. A great man. I'm so sorry for your loss. I just don't understand what happened. We saw he was sick. We just thought he'd get better. Then he didn't. Now I don't know what we're going to do.
Rivers places her hand over the grieving woman's, lets her cry. Then the woman looks up at Rivers again, asks her a question.
Will the same thing happen to me, to us? Could we get what he got?
Nurse Rivers can't help it. She begins to cry too. She honestly hopes her next statement isn't a lie.
No, you're fine. I don't want you to worry. You won't get sick.
Then she wipes the tears away like a professional would.
Now, I want to ask you a favor. You don't have to do it. We don't have to do it. But I want to ask. Do what? The doctors want to learn what caused your husband's death. You know what an operation is. Yes? This is just like an operation, except the person is dead. You open him up. No. But the funeral. I can't let anyone see him like that, Nurse Rivers. I can't. It won't be like that. During the operation, they'll just take a quick look in his chest, his stomach, and his head. When he's dressed and in the casket, no one will even be able to tell that he had an operation. Clothes won't cover his head, though. That's okay, too. Can I describe for you how it works? They make an incision. It's like a small cut in the back of the skull. They pull the hair over the face, and then when they're done, they put the hair back in place. Very, very carefully. In the coffin, he'll be on his back. He'll be lying on the incision. Understand? I've seen a lot of these, and I won't let anything happen to him. After the operation, the doctors will have peace of mind, and so will you. What do you say? Well, okay, Nurse Rivers. You tell them that they can do it. Thank you.
Rivers puts her arm around the woman. She holds her for a long time. It's a gesture she'll repeat often as the study continues for the next 10 years. Dr. John R. Heller recognizes that 1943 is a landmark year in the history of syphilology. This is the year that science has finally found a reliable answer to the disease. Penicillin cures it. Heller is the inspired and energetic new director of the Division of Venereal Diseases at the PHS. He's proud to have inherited the position from Dr. Von der Leer, who's decided it was time to retire. Von der Leer was ready to bring his career to an end, but he made it clear before he left that ending the Tuskegee study was out of the question. Also out of the question, Heller knows, is curing any of the study patients. There will be no discussion of penicillin, and it will not be administered to any of the diseased blacks. As Heller redecorates Von der Leer's former office, he's quite relieved that no one has debated or questioned the penicillin decision. Because it's obvious why it's a good choice. Everyone understands that if the test subjects are given penicillin, they'll no longer have syphilis. And if they no longer have syphilis, then the disease can't be observed as it takes over their bodies. All this work will have been for nothing. Heller personally hopes that the study will continue into the next decade. And under his leadership, it does. By 1951, the study is nearly 20 years old. There's a new PHS director, and under him, Dr. Sidney Olansky and Stanley Schumann. Olansky and Schumann operate out of the PHS Venereal Disease Research Laboratory in Atlanta. They're charged with conducting a full-scale review of the Tuskegee experiment. Schumann is Olansky's assistant, and he's very busy lately. He can't believe how many meetings he has to attend every day. A highly detail-oriented man, Schumann has personally been responsible for helping to track down the PHS officials who got the study off the ground back in 1932. He relished the task and kept his fingers crossed the old guard still believed as much in the study today as they did back then. And he was thrilled when they still backed it to the last man. With the Founding Fathers' support, he and Olansky collected documents and data to undertake a full-scale review of the experiment's procedures. Today, Schumann is in Tuskegee listening to his boss lead a discussion of the study's progress over the past couple decades. There are questions to be answered among the doctors gathered. But of course, the most important question is, should the study persist? All the test subjects are now either old or middle-aged. Schumann hopes desperately that no one will demand the study end. Like his predecessors, he believes that there's still just too much to learn. Luckily, his colleagues agree. Schumann points out to the men gathered in the Tuskegee conference room that, in fact, the age of the participants is a huge plus. Now the study can add a new focus and examine how changes in the body brought about aging differ from changes brought about by ongoing syphilis infection. Plus, Schumann's seen how much the test subjects like the doctors now. On the occasions when the doctors visit the patients' homes, they receive humble but heartfelt gifts, cookies, cornbread, whatever else the Negroes can make. They're not treated for syphilis, but they're treated for other things and grateful for the medical attention, as they should be. The PHS and Tuskegee Institute, Schumann thinks, are doing these men many favors. The men in the room today know the program as the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male. The patients know it as the more innocuous Tuskegee Medical Research Study. And what's wrong with that? They're getting care their patients didn't receive that many of their neighbors couldn't even dream of. Schumann, for his part, declares that he'd like to see the study continue for another 20 years and beyond. It will end when the last subject dies, and not one day before. That's just good science. In June of 1965, Dr. Irwin J. Schatz, 34-year-old cardiologist at the Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, sits down for a quiet evening at home in his living room. The windows are open to let the cool air in, and Schatz just wants to relax after a long day. He likes to stay focused on his profession, even when he's away from the hospital, so for him, relaxing often means diving into the latest issue of a medical journal. He's especially interested in empathy and education in medicine. He picks up a recently published report and begins to read. His pulse quickens and his brow furrows. He can't believe what he's reading. Can't be real, can it? Why is this being discussed so casually, in the open? Is there something he's missing here? He reads it again. Has someone gone mad? Black test subjects deceived, potentially life-saving treatment withheld, and has gone on for 30 years. He rushes to his study, sits down before his typewriter, and tries to keep his rage in check. Days later, Dr. Ann Q. Yobbs at the Centers for Disease Control sorts through her mail. She opens a letter from Irwin J. Schatz and begins to read. She's astonished. It reads, "I'm utterly astounded by the fact that physicians allow patients with a potentially fatal disease to remain untreated when effective therapy is available. If this is the case, then I suggest the United States Public Health Service and those physicians associated with it need to reevaluate their moral judgments in this regard." Yobbs wrinkles her forehead. She jots down a quick note and staples it to Schott's letter. Then she slips the letter in a file and buries the file deep in a basement cabinet no one ever checks. Her note reads, "This is the first letter of this type we have received. I do not plan to answer this letter." Next, on American Scandal, the whistle is blown on the Tuskegee study. The fallout is severe, and the fight for justice begins. From Wondery, this is American Scandal. Just a quick note about our reenactments. We can't always know exactly what was said, but everything in our show is based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound design by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz. Editing by Casey Miner. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.